Good morning. How are we all doing? The Tuesday after midterm, and probably even more important, the Tuesday after the Super Bowl, little things like that that happened since we last got together. Hope you're all doing great. The midterm has been graded. I was able to get the grades out kind of late in the afternoon on Thursday, which is what I always try to do as quickly as possible. So they've been sitting out there. I posted them in that display case right next to the one where I post the answers to the homework assignments and so forth. So there's information out there. Now, there are two listings out there. The listing on the left is by whatever number you coded in on the Scantron form. So you can hopefully find your number there. If there are duplicates, which there probably are, because as I was sifting through the Scantrons, I was saying, oh, that looks like a familiar number, and that looks like a familiar number. So if there are duplicates, you're going to have to come by my office, and I'll try to help you sort out which one belongs to you. So the listing on the left will tell you how many questions you got correct on the exam. Then in the middle, you'll find a sheet that speaks about the exam, that has a grading scale on it. And I've got to tell you, I never record those letter grades at this point in time. The only thing I'm putting in my spreadsheet is numerical scores, right? But so that you can have some idea of what grade you would have gotten on that exam had I actually assigned a letter grade, you can look at that. So that's listed out there. You can kind of give you a feel for where you are in relation to other people. And then there's a listing on the right that is, again, by that number that you coded into the Scantron form, and that shows you which ones you got wrong. So every time as you're reading across with your Scantron number, every time you find a letter for a particular question, that was one that you answered incorrectly, and that letter is the answer that you actually put down. It doesn't tell you what the correct answer was, but it tells you what your incorrect answers were. Now, I do not post the key for the exam, but you're more than welcome to come by and look at it. But what I'd like for you to do first, if you want to come by and look at it, I highly recommend that, is that you write down that whole list of questions you got wrong, so that you know what it was that you got wrong. Write down those answers that you put, so that you know what answer you put. And then you can compare that to the correct answer on the key and maybe get a better idea of why you missed certain questions and so forth. I know sometimes it's just a matter of, it's like you look at it and you say, why did it even mark that answer? So I don't know how to explain that one. Other times you may find a whole area of something that you really didn't know very well, and so you'll find several answers incorrect there and so forth. So it'll help you in your future studying, not only for the next midterm, maybe to help to understand better how you need to study, but also remember the final exam is cumulative, so we are going to come back and go over this material again at the end. I do not reuse questions, so on the final exam, the questions that are there are all going to be different kinds of questions, but it's over the same material, right? So if you do have some big holes in your understanding, you're going to want to kind of seal those up. The average grade, if I were to assign a grade, the average grade on this exam was a C, which is right about where I always see the average grade on these exams. So that's where that all stands. So anyway, that's out there. You can, when we get a break or after class, you can go out there and take a peek and see how you did on the exam and get a better feel for that. Okay, so that's out there. Don't forget, there's a class assignment that's due Friday again. So you're going to want to be sure and get onto that. It speaks to insulin intolerance that is kind of a growing problem in the U.S. population and so forth. So I think you might find that interesting. We're going to finish up talking about circulatory system today, and then there's some information on two problems with insulin levels, that you might have too high insulin, too low insulin, and so forth, diabetes and hypoglycemia, that I'm going to ask you to read a little bit about. There's stuff in the lecture notes, and that kind of ties in a little bit with this homework assignment, though the answers that you're going to be getting for it are going to come from the article that you're going to read, and maybe a little bit of searching that you're going to need to do on the internet. So make sure that you don't forget that there's an assignment
due that's coming up.
Okay, I put this up here. You're looking at this probably thinking, wait a minute, didn't we already have an exam over this stuff? And you're right. But for those of you that are just madly writing all these things down and stuff, to keep your records complete, remember you can always download these sheets from the Moodle site. There are links to pages that allow you to download these things. So if you're keeping a track of the review sheets, you can certainly do that either by writing them down here or by downloading them, printing them, or whatever. So last time, just to kind of get our heads back into where we've been going, you know, we talked about the circulation patterns and the plumbing, so to speak, and so forth. And so I get that funky little diagram down there that kind of describes that whole thing that we had been talking about, right? And it brings in the lymphatic system also. So we talked about that. Remember, the lymphatic system really important for bringing fluids that are being forced out in capillary beds, bringing those fluids back into circulation. And the beauty of the lymphatic system being that not only does that, but we have all these little lymph nodes along the way that help to filter that fluid. There are places where bacteria collect, there are places where white blood cells collect to eat those bacteria, and so forth. So very, very useful part of the immune system in helping us rid ourselves of some of those invaders. And we talked about circulatory patterns and so forth. At the end last time, the first exam material ends here, so below that, we started talking about regulation of blood sugar level. This is going to be another example of homeostasis. I bring it in here because we're talking about blood and circulation and so forth, right? So what's going on with blood sugar levels? How are we regulating those things? And we saw that normal level is somewhere around 700 milligrams per liter of blood. It fluctuates. Different people have different levels and so forth. If you go to the doctor and have your blood sugar levels taken and so forth, you're going to find it not in 700 milligrams per liter, but you're going to find it in, that would be like 70 milligrams per deciliter. So they always do it in tenths of liters instead of liters. We saw that in prolonged fasting individuals, males will go down a little bit, females will go down a little bit more. But even 20, 30 days into a prolonged fast, if your only dietary input is water, say, and you need that water to stay alive, you're still going to have sugar in your blood, even though you're using up that sugar out of the blood. So the evidence that there's something going on, there's some sort of homeostasis going on to help maintain that blood sugar level in the blood at appropriate levels. So that's what we're digging into here. I talked at the end last time about this unusual circulatory pattern that's associated with the liver. So remember, kind of our standard rule of thumb, it goes from an artery, blood's coming out of the heart, in the arteries branch into smaller arteries and so forth. They branch into arterioles. As we go into within organs themselves, we'll have the branching into arterioles and then into capillary beds. The capillary beds reform as venules. And then the venules continue to reform and coalesce into veins. And those veins then will typically connect either with the superior or inferior vein cable. Right, so that's the kind of the standard circulation route that we had been looking at. Remember, with the liver, something unusual is going on. So we saw that typical. Okay, so there are arteries feeding into the gut that are coming. They're branching off the aorta, breaking down into arterioles and capillary beds. All that stuff's going on in the gut. Now, of course, it's in the small intestine. Remember where the nutritional absorption is occurring. So if we think about that region of the gut, we saw that as the capillaries reformed into venules, as veins came out, they didn't go back to the heart. Rather, they fed, or it feeds, the one main vein that comes out feeds into the liver. So it's connected. And then in the liver, that gets broken down again into venules, really, because this is a vein, not an artery. Venules, capillary beds again in the liver, and then that'll reform into venules, and then the main hepatic vein coming out is going to take the blood back to the inferior vena cava. So we've got this interloper, as it were, this liver that's inserted itself in the middle here. What in the world is going on? Remember the terminology
when you've got a vein that connects two capillary beds, we call that a portal vein, right? A portal vein that's kind of carrying that blood between the two capillary beds. And so since this is going into the liver, that was the hepatic portal vein that was coming from the gut into the liver, and then the hepatic vein is coming out of the liver and ultimately feeding back to the vena cava. The liver is the hepatic system. Hepatitis, disease of the liver, right? So we've got that going on. Now people were really interested in what in the world, why is the liver inserted there? What's going on with that? And there's a man named Claude Bernard. You've got his name there at the bottom of the lecture notes on whatever page we're on, 28 it looks like, yes. The bottom of page 28, Claude Bernard, who over 100 years ago now, did a lot of experimentation trying to understand how the physiology of animals worked. And he did so many different things that he kind of got the label, the father of modern physiology. He really kind of brought us into, I guess it would be the 20th century at that point, and did some really clever things. Well, he was really interested in understanding how blood sugar levels were regulated. What was going on with diabetes? And one of the things that they would do, well, let me not jump ahead of myself. So he was familiar with this pattern, and he was wondering, there's got to be a reason that the liver is inserted where it is, that the blood's just not going back to the heart. There's got to be a reason. So could it be that it was having some effect on blood sugar levels or something like that, because it's coming from the gut, and after a meal, of course, that blood's going to be full of nutrients and so forth. So he did an experiment where he was actually going in and he was monitoring sugar levels at various locations. So you got that little table down there at the bottom of page 28. So now he was interested in a couple of situations. So after a meal, and during starvation, hate to use that word, prolonged fasting, yeah, whatever, poor dogs. So that would be just really prolonged. He wasn't starving him to death. It was just prolonged fasting, really. So what's going on? So let's look at the level of the sugar in the hepatic portal vein. And the hepatic vein. So this is level of sugar. Again, we're looking at glucose, right? Blood glucose there. So what he found was that after a meal, no surprise, the level of blood sugar, the level of glucose in that blood would be really high because it's being picked up by the blood from the digestion of the starches and the other carbohydrates and so forth, and it's being picked up into the blood, and really high. So let's just give it little portable pluses. That means that it's really high, okay? I don't know how many pluses are on this scale, but we'll just use it as a relative scale. After the meal. Well, that blood now is going to feed into the liver, so the liver is right in here, right? The hepatic portal coming out, the hepatic vein. I didn't know livers looked like that, but that's kind of an approximation. So what he found was that high level here, not as high a level coming out of the hepatic vein. Okay, so it was apparent that a function of the liver, or a role of the liver, after a meal was to reduce the amount of sugar in the blood. So it lowers the sugar level. That level's going down. Well, he was also interested in knowing, what happens as you get further and further and further from that meal? So with prolonged fasting, continued to monitor the level of the blood, sugar in the blood. He found that there was a level which would be maintained over a longer period of time, just like we talked about in humans. Okay, so there's a level that will be maintained, and you'll see that in the hepatic portal blood, in the blood that's going through there. Now remember, the gut with prolonged fasting isn't picking up any nutrients, so we're not getting any input there. But what he saw in the hepatic vein was that there was more sugar in the blood coming out of the hepatic vein. So during prolonged fasting or starvation, we saw that the liver raises sugar level. It's going to raise that sugar level back up. Well, not nearly as high as after a meal, but it's going to raise that sugar level back up. So it looks like after a meal, the liver is taking sugar out of the blood and likely storing it away. But a long time after the meal, then that liver that has stored that sugar away is now going to start releasing it back into the blood to help maintain blood sugar level. What do we call something that does that, that helps to maintain a relatively constant level? What's the generic name for that? In a homeostatic sense, it's a
effector.
Exactly. So it looks like at least one effector in maintaining blood sugar level is the liver. Now, what's really going on? Let's take a closer look at the liver. And if you go to the next page, I think you have a whole big blank page that you can scratch in, make this diagram. It's kind of a large diagram that I'm going to try to draw for you here. So, let's just focus in on a single liver cell. Okay, so we're going to have a nice big liver cell here. And I'm only going to be focusing in on a part of that liver cell. Okay, so the rest of it's out here somewhere. So there's our liver cell. We know that that liver cell is going to be in fairly close contact with capillaries. They have to be within a couple of cells. They're always within a couple of cells. And then there will be another capillary and so forth. So they're just throughout. So here's a capillary. Capillary that's running through here. Of course, on this scale, the red blood cells, you know, they remember the smallest capillaries are just the size of a red blood cell to go through single file. So that's kind of the scale that we're working on here. We know that, of course, blood is flowing through here, and blood's going to be carrying whatever nutrients. We know that that blood, in this case, is coming from the gut, right? So it's been circulating through the gut. It's picked up nutrients, if indeed nutrients are there, and here we are in the liver now. So blood flow, let's say, is going in that direction. Now, what we're interested in is glucose levels, right? So we know that there's going to be some glucose in this blood plasma, dissolved in the blood plasma. We're interested in maintaining a relatively constant level of glucose so that we can supply areas of the body that don't store glucose, like the brain. Really important to always have glucose in the blood so that you can service the brain and get glucose to the brain. So that's the problem with hypoglycemia, is that the blood sugar level drops way too low, and that's where kind of the dullness, some of the effects of hypoglycemia come into play. So we want to maintain that sugar level at relatively high, whatever that means, enough to supply everything. So if we're after a meal, what's going to happen? After a meal, the level of glucose in the blood is going to be higher than the level of glucose in liver cells. So what will happen is that glucose will will diffuse from the blood into the liver cell. Now, it's going via the interstitial fluid. So don't forget that there's interstitial fluid out here. So it'll diffuse. The level in the interstitial fluid will be lower. It'll diffuse into there. And then the liver cell is going to pick it up. And one of the things that we talked about in Biology 101 is that things like glucose can't just enter cells. That cell membrane really is a barrier for entry. But we talked about how in the membrane there are proteins that act as carriers that literally can carry certain molecules from one side to the other. And our liver cells have carriers for glucose. So they got proteins sitting in the membrane that can grab onto that glucose and they can move it from the outside of the cell to the inside of the cell. So we're able to move that in. So we'll move the glucose from here to here. Another term that rears its ugly head from last term is that this is facilitated transport. Okay, it doesn't require energy to do this. It's going to do it just based on diffusion gradient. So that glucose is going to move from where it's in greater concentration to where it's in lower concentration. Don't have to supply any energy to make this happen in this particular system. So as long as the level of glucose in the liver cell is lower than the level of glucose in the blood, we'll see that glucose is going to move into the liver cell. Now that only works to a certain extent because it's not going to take long before you've got as much glucose in the liver cell as in the blood. So how can we even pack more away? Well, what the liver cell does is it takes that glucose then and it builds that glucose into glycogen. So glycogen is just a large polymer of glucose molecules. And it's a way to kind of store that glucose away. So that as you store it away as glycogen, you no longer have it there as glucose, therefore the level of glucose is down, therefore more glucose is going to feed into the liver cell from the blood. It's kind of like, I don't know if this analogy is going to work or not, but it's kind of like if you had $1 bills flowing through here and they were diffusing in because there were fewer $1 bills in the liver cell than there were out here. Okay, but pretty soon you've got equal numbers $1 bills. That's not going to work. So what if you had some way of changing those $1 bills into $100 bills? So you stash those $1 bills away as $100 bills, and no longer they're $1 bills, so more $1 bills will come in. So you start stashing that money away as $100 bills in the liver cell, except we're collecting it as glucose, as glycogen, and there are literally thousands of glucose monosaccharides that are connected one after the next after the next after the next to make the glycogen molecule. Okay, so it's a way of storing that away. It's a way of building up a glucose reserve, but you've stored it away as glycogen. So this was our after the meal. We'll see that the glycogen reserves in the liver are going to increase and increase. As we get farther and farther from the meal, what's going to happen? Well, the amount of glucose in the blood is going to start to drop because you're using that glucose throughout the body for various things. And at some point, you're going to get to where there's actually less glucose in the blood than there is in the liver cell. And when that happens, then the glucose in the liver cell is going to start moving into the blood. So this is a long time after the meal, prolonged fasting, we'll see the reverse happening. And as long as the glucose level in the liver cell is higher than the blood, then that's going to keep happening. We're going to see the glucose moving back out into the blood. Well, liver cells, again, they don't have a lot of free glucose in there. So in conjunction with that, we'll see that as the glucose level drops in the liver cells are going to start breaking that glycogen down. They're going to start releasing that glucose from the glycogen, kind of pulling it out of the savings account. And that's going to keep the glucose level high enough so that we can continue to resupply the blood with glucose until we run out of glycogen. Now, it's estimated that the liver will store about a day's worth of glucose in the form of glycogen. So you got about that kind of reserve going on. Well, what happens if your prolonged fast goes for 2 days, 3 days, 4 days, and we run out of glycogen? Well, the liver can do other tricky things too. The liver can take amino acids that are circulating in the blood, and those amino acids will also move into the liver cells. And in the liver, there are enzymes present there that they can take certain amino acids. Can't do it with all the amino acids, but they can take certain amino acids and they can actually convert those into glucose. So here we are, we're breaking proteins down, we got the amino acids circulating in the blood, we're taking some of those, we're rebuilding those into glucose, and that glucose now can supply the blood from the liver cell that can supply the blood with more glucose to help to maintain higher glucose level in the blood for the prolonged time. Yeah, question?
You know, we'll talk about that in a few minutes when we talk about hormonal control over this sort of whole thing. It's really related to glucose level in the blood. And it's a level, if the level drops to a certain point, it's going to stimulate that process. So it doesn't have to be prolonged starvation. At some point, if the level gets low enough, it's going to
do it. Now, what we're doing here in the liver is we're taking these, we're making new glucose. Okay, so hang on to that. We're making new glucose that can now feed into the system. And the term that's been applied to this is, so when you see this, is gluco. Okay, there's the glucose part of it. Gluconeogenesis. Gluconeogenesis. Neo means new, genesis, a beginning, so forth. Gluconeogenesis, we're making new glucose from amino acids. We're converting protein, basically, into sugar. Now, we can do that for quite a while, but as I mentioned last time or so, as we get into starvation, once you get about 40 or 50 days out, and if you're really not putting any dietary input in, your body's going to start scavenging really necessary proteins, and it's going to be doing, in part, it's going to be doing gluconeogenesis with some of those amino acids and stuff, and things start to become irreversible. So even if you get good medical treatment to bring you out of that starvation, there are going to be after effects from that because of the way the body has scavenged protein to maintain glucose levels, to maintain itself as long as it possibly can. So a homeostatic mechanism here to keep the level up. So again, it doesn't do it with all amino acids, just certain ones, and that will help. So the liver is an effector, and we're going to see that there are actually some other effectors involved here too in maintaining blood sugar level, but the liver is one of them. That's basically how that's operating. So the next question that comes to mind perhaps is, well, if that's an effector, what's the sensor? You know, what's actually reading glucose levels? And this is a hormonal effect here to stimulate gluconeogenesis and so forth. What's the sensor that is actually monitoring blood glucose level and communicating with the effector or the effectors in order to raise or lower blood glucose? Now this looks pretty simple here, what I've described to you, but it is quite a bit more complicated. Now it turns out that the sensors, plural, two of them, the sensors for blood glucose level are housed in the pancreas. Now what do we normally think of as the pancreas producing? What did it produce for us when we talked about the digestive process? Enzymes, right? Lots of different digestive enzymes. Enzymes that will digest all sorts of things, including protein, which is key here, and alkaline fluids and so forth. But, you know, do you think of the pancreas as being the sensor for blood sugar level? Getting back to Claude Bernard, it was known that with some experiments he did, that if you took a dog and removed its pancreas, okay, so we're trying to figure out what all these different organs are doing, right? And it's pretty obvious what the heart's doing, some of the other things, but what is that darn pancreas doing that's sitting in there? Maybe besides, is doing anything besides supplying digestive hormones. If you take a dog and remove the pancreas, it was known that very shortly thereafter, that dog would present symptoms just like diabetes, which would be large amounts of urine, and when you tasted that urine, it would be sweet. And in those days, that's the only way they had of testing that, you know. Is there sugar in the urine or not? And if it's sweet, that's because you're getting sugar. And that relates to the fact that with diabetes, you've got high levels of blood sugar to begin with, and as your blood gets filtered through the kidneys can't recoup all that sugar, and so that sugar goes out with the urine and the water, the copious amounts of urine that are formed, the water follows it osmotically. So because that urine is very, very concentrated, a lot of water is going to go with it and so forth. So that was known, that was a given, that the pancreas, if you did something to disrupt its function or remove it or whatever, then you had symptoms of diabetes. So people focused in, they thought, okay, well that suggests that the sensors for this whole process must reside within the pancreas. Can we show that? So what we're looking for now, what they were looking for, is not necessarily the sensors themselves, but if the sensors are in the pancreas, there has to be some way of communicating with the effectors. And so what people were looking for was whether the pancreas was producing hormones, because that's the most logical means of communication. Was it producing hormones that were getting in the blood that were communicating with the effectors that were helping to regulate blood sugar level? So they would kind of take the standard procedure. You take a pancreas, you grind it up, you isolate various things that you find in there and so forth, and you test them to see if they're active in reversing the effect of removing the pancreas. And it was just like a stone wall. People kept hitting the stone wall, and they couldn't demonstrate at all that the pancreas was producing any kind of hormone. So really, really frustrating, until someone got the brilliant idea and said, you know, wait a minute, let's think about the pancreas. What does the pancreas do? 97% of pancreas tissue produces digestive enzymes. They said, I wonder if maybe when we're taking the pancreas and we're grinding it up, we're trying to isolate a hormone or something, I wonder if those digestive enzymes might not be chewing up the hormone before we get a chance to isolate the hormone. To see if indeed that hormone exists. And that's what was happening. And once they realized that, there are certain things you can add to your mixture and so forth to deactivate the enzymes. And once they realized that, then it became apparent that the pancreas was producing not one but two hormones that are involved in helping to regulate the blood sugar level. So those are the things, the struggles that you go through sometimes trying to figure these things out. You got to take into account everything that's going on, not just focus in on your one little problem, because that might be frustrating the whole thing. So, when they figured that out, the search became a little bit easier. Now, let's take a look at the pancreas. And I told you that 97% of the pancreas tissue is involved in making digestive enzymes. And so the cells, we find a lot of cells like this that are producing digestive enzymes. They're releasing those in areas into a duct. That duct is feeding into the duodenum, the very beginning of the small intestine, so that those enzymes can get fed in there. 3% of pancreas tissue is these little isolated patches. They're not connected to a duct or anything. They're just isolated patches of cells that we find throughout the pancreas. They're called islets of Langerhans. Islets of Langerhans, little islets of cells within the greater pancreas tissue. It turns out that not only are those the areas that produce the hormones that are going to help regulate blood sugar level, but those cells that are producing the hormones are the sensors. So they're going to produce the hormone in response to level of blood in the sugar, level of sugar in the blood. Let's make it right, level of sugar in the blood. Okay, so they're going to do that. And if the sugar level goes up, then they're going to produce more of one hormone that's going to help to bring it back down. If the sugar level goes down too low, they're going to produce more of a second hormone that helps to bring it back up again. So let's take a quick look at these. There are two types of islet cells. So each one is going to produce one of these hormones. So hopefully you all made the transition to page 30 here. Two types of cells. We call them the alpha cells. And usually we identify them with the Greek letters, so alpha cells. So that's alpha. And the beta cells. So that's the Greek small letter beta. And really they're alpha islet cells and beta islet cells, because we find them in the islets of Langerhans, so two different kinds of cells that are in there. These are the sensors for blood sugar level. Let's look at the beta islet cells first. So the beta islet cells produce a hormone that you're all familiar with, insulin. So they're going to produce insulin. Insulin is a small protein. Small protein, it's composed actually of two chains that have a total of 51 amino acids. And that is a small protein. Okay. That's why, we'll see that the other hormone is a protein also. That's why the digestive enzymes, they're chewing these things up before they could ever find them in there, until they realize that that's what might be going on, because they're proteins that are being produced. The hormones are proteins. If the level of glucose goes up in the blood, so this would be like typically after a meal, something like that. If the level goes up, then the beta islet cells release more insulin. So this insulin gets into the bloodstream. Now you think, well, wait a minute, these little islets of Langerhans aren't connected to anything. But remember, there's capillary beds throughout, right? So there's a really good blood supply in here. And so the insulin just gets secreted by the beta islet cells and is going to get picked up in the capillary bed. It's going to get picked up and put into circulation in the circulatory system. So that's not a big problem. So we'll get the insulin circulating. So remember, glucose goes up, more insulin is now circulating, and insulin actually has three target organs. So insulin is going to target skeletal muscle. It's going to target fat tissue. And it's going to target the liver. So it's got those three target organs, not just a single target organ. And it's actually got two effects on these. So on the skeletal muscle and the fat, it's going to make these more permeable to glucose. More permeable, which means the glucose can enter them more readily. Okay, it does this. The insulin does this by binding with a protein, by a receptor protein that's on the outer membrane of these cells, and that has a series of effects that allows those cells to take up more of that glucose. Well, what's going to be the effect if you're taking more glucose into those cells? It's going to lower the level of glucose, right? Because you're now putting it away, you're at least getting it into those cells more efficiently. In the fat and the liver, its effect is to, I'm sorry, not the fat, what am I thinking of? The skeletal muscle and the liver. So fat tissue, when it takes up more glucose, you know what it's going to do with it. It's going to make it into fat. Right? It's going to store it away as fat. in the skeletal muscle in the liver, it increases the rate of glycogen synthesis. It's going to increase the rate of glycogen synthesis. So this extra glucose that's coming in now, because these cells are more permeable, at least in the case of the skeletal muscle, it's going to help to store more of that away. And in the liver, we saw if we store more glycogen away, that's going to allow the liver to remove more glycogen from the blood. So in both of these situations, whether it's making the cells more permeable to glucose or whether it's increasing the rate of glycogen synthesis, it's going to lower the level of glucose in the blood. So that's how insulin is working. Help lower the level of glucose in the blood. So the effect of insulin is to lower that level. Okay, any questions about that? Any questions? I just been a chatterbox down here, I know. Yeah. I'm sorry, these two different effects are happening at the same time. Yeah, because that insulin is just circulating in the blood and it's targeting the different areas. Yeah. Any other? Okay. Now let's talk about the alpha islet cells. The alpha islet cells release a different hormone. This one's called glucagon. It's also a protein, but it's a smaller protein yet. Smaller protein. It's just a single chain that is composed of 29 amino acids. If the glucose level drops, okay, so now we're back to our prolonged fast, right? So we haven't had dietary input for a long time. So if the glucose drops, then the alpha islet cells produce more glucagon. And it's the same story, you know, they're all part of that. So that glucagon is going to be released. It's going to be picked up by the capillaries and circulated around the body from the pancreas. The glucagon has a single target. So unlike the insulin that has several targets, glucagon has a single target, and that's the liver. And it's effect on the liver is to do a couple of things that we've already talked about. So it's got a couple of effects. One is going to increase the level of glycogen breakdown. So if it's increasing the amount of glycogen that's being broken down, what's it doing to the glucose level in the cell? It's increasing that, right? And so as you increase the level of glucose in the liver cells, that means that likely more of it's going to move then out into the blood. So we're going to help to supply glucose to the blood that way. And the other thing that glucagon does is that it stimulates gluconeogenesis. Stimulates gluconeogenesis, which of course is converting amino acids into glucose. So now we're producing more glucose there, and that glucose is going to move into the blood also. Now, real quickly, I want to show you just a little bit of the mechanism of this, because it's such a typical mechanism for how a hormone works. so many hormones work similarly to this. So if you can imagine, this is the cell membrane of a liver cell, and there are certain proteins that reside in that membrane, and I'll just kind of sketch that like that. So here's a protein that's kind of residing in that membrane that's a receptor for glucagon. A glucagon is going to have a particular shape to it, and this receptor will also have a particular shape to it, so that the only thing that can actually bind tightly to this receptor is going to be glucagon. So we'll just draw the glucagon, you know, as kind of looking like this for now, just a little schematic diagram of it. So this is our glucagon that is has been released by the alpha islet cells, right? It's circulating in the blood. It binds with the receptor right here. When that binding happens, then that activates a whole series of things. Activates an enzyme. That activates another several enzymes. So we got a whole cascade of events that happen here. So we got this whole cascading set of events that happen of activating enzymes in the cell, which ultimately lead to these effects. So they ultimately lead to increasing glycogen breakdown, so there's one set of enzymes that are going to do that, and they ultimately lead to stimulating the gluconeogenesis. There's another set of enzymes that are going to do that. So like I said, this is very, very typical for how hormones that bind to receptors on the outside of cells work. They tend to work through a series of enzyme activations and intermediates to that that ultimately activate certain pathways in the cell that cause the effect of that hormone being present. So in this case, for the glucagon, that's what's going on there. The result of this is that the level of glucose in the blood goes up. So we've now got two pathways that we're working with that relate to blood sugar level. One pathway that comes into play when the level's too high, and a second pathway that comes into play when the level's too low. And by having two pathways like that, you can much more precisely control your sugar levels, because you can control it on both sides. You're not just controlling, like the refrigerator that we talked about earlier, you're only controlling it on one side, right? You're only controlling it if it gets too warm inside. Here, we're controlling it on both sides of that set point. Okay, any questions about that? Okay, so before we take a break, I want to do one last thing here, and that is to draw out the homeostatic control diagram. What does this look like, what we've talked about so far? So there on page 31, you've hopefully still got most of that page empty so that we can make a nice big diagram of that homeostatic control mechanism. So, first, there's a set point of some sort, right? And the set point for this particular homeostatic control mechanism is going to be the level of glucose in the blood. Okay, so we've got that set point, and we saw that that set point may vary a bit depending on your nutritional state, but still, even with starvation, that set there, well, one set point for males and a slightly lower set point, what we might consider a set point for females, because that's where the blood sugar level is going to stay, even though you don't have blood sugar coming in. So it's a 650 or 400, depending on whether you're male or female. monitoring. So we got to have some monitoring. We've actually got two sensors that are monitoring this. So we've got two pathways that we're going to draw out here. So let's put the alpha islet cells on this pathway, and let's put the beta islet cells on this pathway. And we know that the alpha islet cells produce glucagon. We know that the beta islet cells produce insulin. Now, these are the sensors, right? And the hormones are the way of communicating with the effectors. So, those are our sensors for this. They're monitoring the level of glucose. If the glucose level starts to drop, we saw that that's going to be picked up by the alpha islet cells, and we're constantly, it's not an on and off situation, okay? It's not like, oh, we got to a certain level, we got to kick on glucagon production, or we got too high, we got to click on insulin. It's always kind of relative. So when you've got more glucagon being produced, you've got less insulin being produced. When you've got more insulin being produced, you've got less glucagon being produced. So in response to glucose level, if the level's high, these alpha islet cells aren't going to be producing much glucagon, but as the level starts to drop, they're going to produce more and more glucagon, and vice versa over here with the insulin. If the level's high, they're going to be producing a lot of insulin. If the level's low, that's going to drop off. They're going to produce a lot less insulin. So kind of relative kinds of things. So we know that if the level's low, or I should say that the glucagon is going to communicate with the liver, and the effect of glucagon on the liver is to increase glycogen breakdown. Right, so that's increasing the amount of glucose that's available to put into the sugar. So increases glycogen breakdown. And it also increases gluconeogenesis. So not only are we breaking glycogen down, get that sugar out, but we're making those amino acids now, certain amino acids, into glucose so that we can go ahead and put those into the blood also. Over on the beta islet side with the insulin, remember we saw that there were the three effectors, the liver, the muscle. And I'm just saying muscle because I'm kind of running out of space here, but remember that's skeletal muscle. It's not heart muscle. It's not smooth muscle. So the liver, the muscle, and the fat cells. And remember the effect of insulin on the liver and the muscle. One effect was to increase glycogen synthesis. So we're producing more glycogen. I've got to abbreviate. That's glycogen, that funny little thing that probably doesn't look like anything up there. Oh dear. Glycogen. Increased glycogen, let's say formation. So we're going to make, oh, that was a terrible thing to do. We're going to make more glycogen. And then remember the effect on the muscle and the fat was to increase uptake of glucose. So I'm sorry, that's kind of sloppy there, but you can hopefully refer back to the notes you've already taken. So effects on the liver and muscle increase glycogen formation, so that's removing glucose from the system, and then the muscle and fat increase the uptake of glucose, so that's also removing. So two separate pathways, and ultimately, we want to go back and correct that, an error in the set point, right? So we've got that leg of the pathway, and we've got this leg of the pathway. So we can look at this and say, okay, what if the glucose level goes down, prolonged fasting, right? Well, we're going to be really working with this leg. Level is too low. The alpha islet cells are going to produce more glucagon. They're going to stimulate the liver to break that glycogen down to provide that to the blood. They're also going to increase gluconeogenesis, so they're making more glucose to begin with. So that's going to help to raise that level back up or maintain it at some sort of a set point, right? So that's that loop, if too low. So we might say, okay, that's going to take that loop there. On the other hand, if the level's too high, then we're going to take this other loop, right? If the level's too high, the beta islet cells are going to respond by producing more insulin. That insulin is going to help the muscle and fat cells remove more of that glucose by increasing their uptake, and it's going to help the liver and the muscle cells to remove some of that glucose also by forming it into more glycogen, storing it away for later in reserve. So if it's too high, we're going to go down that route. Too low, we'll go down that route. So it gives us the ability to maintain that glucose level at fairly constant levels so that we can always be supplying the areas that need them and so forth. This will be a good thing to remember, this diagram. Okay, let's take a break here. And if you need a glucose break, you know, now would be a time of glucose fix. This would be a good time for it. In case you think that your liver isn't, or your alpha islet cells aren't putting out quite enough glucagon. Okay. I guess it's time for us to get back to work here. I forgot, I need to remind you, if you're doing the creative project for the first third, it's due next Thursday at the beginning of class, right? So this coming Thursday, 2 days from now, at the beginning of class, and I will look forward to an avalanche of projects and creativeness and so forth that you're all going to bring to me. So, okay. The last thing that I want to say about this, and then we've got to move on to another topic, is this issue of diabetes and hypoglycemia. And if you look on pages 32, 33 in the lecture notes, you'll find a description of both of those. And I'm going to ask you to go ahead and just read through those on your own so that you have a feel, because they're both a problem with insulin production, right? So what happens if your pancreas isn't producing enough insulin? What happens to blood sugar levels? What happens if if you don't have enough receptors on those target cells for the insulin? What happens to glucose levels? What happens if you produce too much insulin? What happens to glucose levels and so forth? So those are those two things that you can look at on these pages, and then some more study questions. But what I'd like to shift gears now and kind of move away from this whole discussion we've been having about the circulatory system and blood sugar levels and things like that, and start talking about the respiratory system. Circulatory system is key to everything because it circulates everything, right? It gets things around. So we've looked at the circulatory system in the context of nutrients, picking up nutrients from the digestive tract, circulating them around to all the cells and so forth. Well, we also have to be able to circulate gases. We need to get oxygen in. We all know we need to get oxygen in. Most of us know we've got to get rid of carbon dioxide. Carbon dioxide is a waste product. It's formed. A waste product of cellular metabolism. And we call that gas exchange. We've got to be able to exchange gases with the environment. And we all know what happens if we don't exchange the gases properly. You asphyxiate, right? You die because of lack of oxygen intake or too much CO2 building up in your blood. That can, we'll talk more about that a little bit also. And I think you might be surprised when we talk about some of these things, what actually regulates how fast you're breathing and some of those things. But well, that's a story for another day, like Thursday. So over here on page 36, need for gas exchange. We have to have an adequate supply of oxygen. We've got to get rid of carbon dioxide out of the body. So those are very, very important. Now, we call that gas exchange, and we call that process respiration. Not to be confused with cellular respiration that we talked about last term, where we were looking at the breakdown of sugars and the utilization of oxygen and as part of that process and so forth. So we looked at that last term. That was cellular respiration. When we talk about the respiratory system or this process of gas exchange, we're talking about respiration. And I'm sorry, there's nothing I can do about the overlap of terminology here. Just be aware of that. So gas exchange via respiration. Now let's talk about oxygen first. Well, of course, oxygen is in the air that we breathe in. And you can take air and you can analyze that air. And some of the things that we're interested in, about 21% of air at sea level is oxygen. I'll give you a more precise number in just a minute, but we can, for now, we can round it up. About 21% is oxygen. About 78% is nitrogen. Air, right? We're talking about gases now, so it's nitrogen gas. About 0.04% is carbon dioxide. So carbon dioxide is a very minor component of what's in our air. And then depending on where you are, depending on the day, it's going to be different in desert than at the coast or by lakes and so forth. But remember, we're talking about at sea level here, about 1.25% is water vapor. Now, there are lots of other things in the air, too. Lots of other things. But those are just some of the things that are maybe pertinent to our discussion. So in order to get the air in, we need a means of getting this air into our bodies. We need a means of exchanging the gases, getting the oxygen literally into the circulatory system so we can circulate it, getting carbon dioxide out. So we need a means of gas exchange to be able to do that. Now, gas exchange occurs by means of diffusion. Okay, I've already used that word with you today when we were talking about glucose and moving in and out of the liver. Remember diffusion from last term. Diffusion is the movement of substances from where they're in higher concentration to where they're in lower concentration. So something's diffusing, it's just going from where there's more of it to where there's less of it. I remember too that diffusion is just a physical process. It is a result of the fact that all molecules are moving. The only time a molecule might not be moving is if it's at absolute zero. We call absolute zero, and that's kind of defined as where all molecular movement stops. Physicists keep trying to hit absolute zero. They've gotten very close, but I'm not sure that I'm aware of anywhere where absolute zero has actually been achieved. Everything would stop. Other than that, things are moving, and so this process of diffusion is just a result of those movements that are occurring all the time. So how do we accomplish this? And another question I want to deal with is how do we predict which way gas exchange will occur? if we're interested in knowing, like, will oxygen always go into the blood if it's in the lungs? Or might there be conditions where that wouldn't happen? Will CO2 always come out of the blood when it's in the lungs or not? You know, how can we predict what's going on? So let's talk a little bit about gas pressure and some other things, and then we'll take a look at that. Gas pressure in the air, or pressure, air pressure is what we're really talking about, is measured in millimeters of mercury. Hg is the abbreviation, the chemical abbreviation for mercury, millimeters of mercury, and we measure that with a barometer. Right? You're probably all familiar with a barometer, but you may not know exactly how a barometer works. The older, more precise mercury barometers worked as follows. You take a reservoir of mercury. Okay, mercury is a liquid, a silver liquid, so we have a reservoir of mercury. You take a long tube that's closed at one end, so it's only open at one end, it's closed at the other end. You fill that tube with mercury, and then you very carefully turn that tube upside down into this reservoir of mercury so that the open end is down in the reservoir. Okay, kind of like that. And that mercury, some of that mercury is going to settle out of there, so you're going to get a level here of the mercury. And by measuring that level, so what we're measuring here is the distance between here and here. That's going to reflect what we call the barometric pressure, or the air pressure. It's going to change from day to day depending upon what's going on with the weather. The barometric pressure is usually changing over time. If we're getting rainy weather, the pressure is going down. If we're getting dry, sunny weather, the pressure is going up, and so forth. The barometric pressure changes. Now, what's happening with that barometric pressure is something that you don't see. There's this atmosphere surrounding us, right? And you don't realize how much the weight of that atmosphere presses down on you, because we're used to that, right? We're used to it. But it does. It presses down a lot. So we've got this, the weight of this atmosphere pressing down, and it's pressing down on this reservoir that the long tube is sitting in. And if that presses down with less pressure, then it's going to back off, and this level is going to go up a little bit, and that means that level is going to go down. And if it presses down with more pressure, just the opposite, that level here is going to go down a little bit more, that level in here is going to go up a little bit more. So that's how the barometric pressure readings vary. Now, in mercury, in terms of if mercury is our liquid, at sea level, what we kind of consider a standard atmospheric pressure is 760 millimeters mercury. This is a standard atmospheric pressure at sea level. Millimeters of mercury. By the way, another term that you may come across, instead of millimeters of mercury is TOR. One TOR equals 1 millimeter of mercury. So you may see that term. It's so ingrained in me to use the term millimeters of mercury that's what we're going to be using, but you may come across TOR. As you go up in elevation, there's less air over you. There's less atmosphere. I mean, the atmosphere is kind of a sphere around the planet, right? So you go up in elevation, there's less of that pressing down on you. And so the atmospheric pressure goes down. As you go down in elevation, you get more and more of that pressing down. So the atmospheric pressure goes up. And in the United States, Death Valley, I think, is the lowest point. And that, I don't know its elevation, but it's way below sea level. And so the atmosphere, the atmospheric pressure in Death Valley would be higher than it would be at sea level. So the atmospheric pressure is related to all these gases that are pushing down on us. But again, as I say, we don't realize that because that's what we're used to. That's what we're built to withstand. Water weighs a whole lot more. If any of you have ever snorkeled or scuba dived stuff, you know the effect of water pressure as you go down. You don't have to go down very far, and you feel more and more pressure against your body. And so some of you may have experienced that. That's because water is so much heavier than the atmosphere around us that's pressing down on us. The first barometers were not made with mercury, though. They're actually made with water. Same idea. A long tube filled with water, closed at one end, put down into a reservoir of water. It's just the water is a whole lot lighter. So where 760 millimeters of mercury is kind of the standard pressure at sea level, by the way, 760 millimeters of mercury is the equivalent of 29.92 inches of mercury. Okay, that's what 760 millimeters is, 29.2. A water barometer, atmospheric pressure, would be about 33.9 feet tall. Okay, so you're measuring it in that, or 10.3 meters. So for water, that equivalency is 10.3 meters. Or 33.9 feet. So you can see why we use mercury rather than water. It's really kind of inconvenient to try to carry around a water barometer that's 32 feet tall. But there are great stories about the first person who created one of these things and how he noticed a relationship between stormy weather and good weather and so forth, and all the townspeople thought that it was his device that was causing all this stuff, and he got into a lot of trouble with the townspeople because of that. Anyway, that's for another time and day, but mercury is kind of our gold standard now. Now, when we measure this pressure, this amount of pressure that's beating down on us, it's the sum total of all the different gases that are in that air. Okay, so we talked about air is about 21% oxygen, 78% nitrogen, on lots of other things in there too. So that total pressure that we're feeling is the total sum of all of those beating down on us. The entire contribution. Now, the contribution of a single gas. So we're interested right now in oxygen. What's the contribution of oxygen to that atmospheric pressure? It turns out it's a real simple thing to compute. The contribution of a single gas, let me write this out. So the contribution of a single gas to the total atmospheric pressure is the percent of the gas in the mixture times the pressure. Okay, it's just the percent of the gas in the mixture times the pressure. So if we're looking at air, say, okay, the ocean on this fine day is 760 millimeters mercury. What's the contribution of oxygen? It's going to be 21% of that. But we can actually use a little bit more precise numbers as you've got down there. So in that little table near the bottom, oxygen is really 20.71% of air. So if we multiply that times 760, we come up with 157 millimeters mercury. And we would call that the partial pressure of oxygen in that air. Partial pressure. We're interested in knowing that. And we would just abbreviate that, so the 157 millimeters of mercury is just the P. Just the P is going to stand for partial pressure, the pressure of oxygen. So a little subscript there. The pressure of oxygen in that air at sea level is 157 millimeters. That's its contribution to the whole thing. For carbon dioxide, you can run the numbers out there the same, the partial pressure of carbon dioxide. So the PCO2 is 0.3 millimeters of mercury. So again, not much of a contribution at all to the total pressure, because it's a very small component. Now, why do we bother with this? It's because if we're going to make predictions of which way gases are going to move, we have to have some way of quantifying the level of gas between the two areas. So remember, gas is going to move by diffusion. It's going to move from where it's more concentrated to where it's less. In this case, the partial pressure gives us a way of quantifying that. So we would say, in this case, the oxygen, if it's going to move from where the partial pressure is higher to where the partial pressure is lower, because that's going to reflect quantity. Okay, so that's why we're going to all the trouble now figuring out partial pressures. Now, let's suppose we have a setup. So we've got a beaker here of water. And let's suppose we have a little hose, a little tube that we run into this beaker of water, and we've got this hooked up to some sort of a gas jet or something that we can bubble different gases in. Okay, so we're going to bubble gases into this water. So let's say, first of all, let's suppose that we're just bubbling air. Okay, we've talked about how air has a partial pressure of 157 millimeters, has a PO2 of 157 millimeters for oxygen, right? Suppose that the PO2 of oxygen in the water is 120 millimeters of mercury. Okay, we know that the air coming in is 157, and that doesn't look like 157. The air coming in is 157, and we know that the water itself is 120. What's going to happen to the partial pressure of oxygen in that water as we continue to bubble air through it? Another way to ask that question: which way is water going to, or oxygen going to move? Will it move into the water or out of the water? From where it's higher to where it's lower, right? So it's going to move into the water. So, barring other sorts of things, if we bubbled this air through here long enough, we might expect that partial pressure of the oxygen to reach the 157 level. And once it did, there'd be no net movement either way, right? On the other hand, what if the PO2 in the water somehow, for some reason, was 180 millimeters mercury? Okay, so now we got a new example here. Now it's 180. Where's that oxygen going to move to? It's going to move into the bubbles, right? Because the oxygen level in the bubble is 157, got a partial pressure of 157. We've got a higher level out here, 180, so it's going to move into the bubbles. We'd actually see the oxygen pressure in the water move down as a result of that. So it's strictly physical phenomenon. It's strictly moving from where the pressure's higher to where the pressure's lower. And that gives us a tool for making predictions as long as we can compare the same thing. So we're going to be interested in oxygenating our blood. Okay, if we know the partial pressure of oxygen in the lung, and we know the partial pressure of oxygen in the blood, then we can predict, is the oxygen going to move into the blood? Is it going to move out of the blood? Is it going to stay put? What's it going to do? So this gives us a tool for being able to do that. Okay, any questions about that? Okay, so in humans, gas exchange occurs in the lungs, right? And so where did my picture of a lung go?
we looked at the lungs, the air passing, so that the artery coming in is actually colored blue here because it's the oxygen flow coming in, red for the vein going out, and then here's the trachea, it divides into bronchii and into smaller and smaller tubes, and finally ends in these little air sacs, these alveoli. And these alveoli are surrounded by capillaries. So that's where the gas exchange is going to occur within us, is in those alveoli.
Oxygen and carbon dioxide are going to move in or out of the blood by diffusion, depending on where the pressures are higher, where the levels are higher. Now, there's an interesting thing about the air in the alveolus.
If you were to take and thread a little tube down, I'm not recommending you do this to your roommate by any means, unless they're asleep, but if you threaded a little tube right down into their lungs, right down into the alveolus, and if you drew some air out of there, then you analyze that air, you find that that air is very different from the air around us.
And that's because when you're sitting at rest, you're only changing about 10% of the air every time that's in your lungs. And you know, sometimes if you're sitting at rest, you'll take that deep breath to kind of get a little bit more and so forth, but you're only changing about 10% of the air. So oxygen is continuing to get drawn out of that air, and carbon dioxide is continuing to get put in. So if we analyze that air, it's very, very different. And you have a table somewhere. You have a table there in the middle of page 37 that shows us what air in the alveolus actually looks like compared to air in the surrounding looks like. So if we look at that table, so air inspired, air that's being brought in, has a partial pressure of 20.7. We've talked about that, of oxygen. In the alveolar air, it's down to 13.2. Okay, because we've drawn a lot of that oxygen out. CO2 in the air inspired coming in, 0.04. In the alveolar air, it's a lot higher because we've been putting carbon dioxide into that air and we haven't been exchanging it efficiently. It's up to 5.3. So if you look at the partial pressures in the alveoli, they're very different from the partial pressures atmospherically. Partial pressure of oxygen in your alveolus is only 100 millimeters mercury, whereas in the air, it's 157, right? Partial pressure of carbon dioxide in the alveolus is up to 40 millimeters of mercury, way high compared to the air. That's the environment that we have to deal with when we talk about gas exchange. And I'll stop there, and we'll pick that up next time and see what's going on in the body to deal with that.